And welcome back to Coast, Eric Luthart with us, our special guest. Doctor, what about when they put the chips in people's heads? Might they develop a kill switch where they can just shut you all down?
Well, that's a tougher question. I guess they'd have to put some explosives in there. So I don't think that they can do a full brain kill switch. I guess just thinking about this is that unless, of course, they created some pattern that induced a seizure, and I guess that could theoretically be a kill switch.
That would be something. You know what? I wouldn't put it past them, Eric.
You know what? I think that, you know, once you achieve the ability to hack an implant, then the ability to modify that implant for malicious purposes presents itself. As an example, if you think of former Vice President Dick Cheney, he actually has a pacemaker in his heart, and he actually had the wireless component turned off so that people couldn't hack his implant
that's
and
right.
cause him to have a heart attack.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And he's got a transplanted heart to boot.
That's right. That's right.
He's
a multitude of modern technologies.
He really is. That has kept him alive. It's almost as if, as you've been talking about, somebody has downloaded his brain. Unfortunately, they put it in a so-so body. But, you know, he just seems to go on forever, doesn't he?
That's exactly right. Some people love it and some people don't.
Yep, absolutely. This quest for life. I think it would be strange to have a transplanted heart. It keeps you alive, no doubt, but it would be weird.
Well, when you think about it, quite literally, your life is built upon the death of somebody else. That heart was the result of somebody living with it for a long, long time.
Well, that's absolutely true. So when you're writing the Red Devil 4, come across anything else that was a little difficult for you, or was it an easy write for you?
I truly enjoyed writing it, because I think that it really forced me to push the boundaries of what's possible and really to follow things to their logical conclusions. And so, as an example, it really made me take on a new perspective of, okay, with, you know, what we do now, how does it change when we have an implant? And once you live with that lens for a couple of years, you see how everything can change. So one of my characters, for instance, his name's the Chameleon. Now, we always talk about implants for the purposes of, you know, controlling a phone or you know, the communication type of stuff. But, you know, what's to stop us from, you know, just really having wild body modifications? You can now, and this character of mine, the Chameleon, he had his entire body implanted with LEDs so that he could really have all of his thoughts and emotions reflected on this ever-changing tattoo. And I think that really people, you know, people have the ability to change themselves to their whim. And so it won't just be, you know, hey, I can download something. The massive ability to really alter things and alter your biology doesn't just stop at your brain.
What about the soul? Does the soul fit into any of this?
Well,
You did a little theology in your earlier days.
I did, you know, in some senses, you know, our soul is this nugget of individual value that really represents us. And in some sense, it's hard to put your finger on because is your soul your mind? Well, if it is, then, you know, then in some senses, your mind, which perhaps is your soul, is really a reflection of your complexity, meaning that as information becomes more complex and self-aware, it has a moral value to it that has a soulness to it that is more than the sum of its parts. And it, in that sense, you know, that our soul may now, you know, live in a different body, that's okay. You know, does that really affect, for instance, with Dick Cheney having a new heart that belonged to somebody else, did he lose his soul? I don't think so.
Did he ever have one?
Well, wow, that becomes a bigger question, you know, which I will not comment on, because the NSA may be listening.
Yeah.
But, you know, for instance, as we change our body parts, Does that affect our soul? I don't think so. But taking it to the extreme, well, what if we basically just download ourselves into some type of virtual reality? Do we still have that soul? As long as our mind and our complexity and our personal ability to reflect is still there, I think so. But I think people will argue with that.
How quickly is science and fiction meshing together? It's happening now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think in a strange sort of way, I think we quite literally are living in the future. That really, in a lot of ways, if you can imagine it these days, it really is a matter of when and how much does it cost. That I think the ability for humans today to enact their imagination of what the future can be is, in some senses, happening now. And so it's an amazing time that we're living in.
Let's take some calls here for you, Eric, as they line up. We'll go to Richard in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin, first-time caller. Richard, go ahead. Thank you for calling.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Richard.
I'm wondering if the doctor has addressed the motor skill dysfunctional problems caused by Parkinson's disease or if that's strictly a dopamine problem.
So with regard to Parkinson's, that is a dopamine problem. Some of the deeper structures in the brain, notably the subthalamic nucleus, which produces our brain's dopamine for movement. And certainly brain-computer interfaces have been a solution for Parkinson's for over a decade now, where over 100,000 people today have implanted brain stimulators to improve that nucleus's output and reduce the motor symptoms. And I think that type of technology will continue to improve, and I think they're going to figure out new ways to improve that circuitry with both stimulators and other methods. And some people have talked about that method of optogenetics, genetically modifying those regions so that they can be stimulated not by electricity but by light.
You ever see the day where military applications are done on this, where they go into the brain and eliminate fear for a soldier, for example?
You know, in some senses, it's happening already today, once again. So there's a technology called direct transcranial stimulation. And really what it is you put a couple pads on your head. They're these large, spongy electrodes. And you can pass current from an area over your left ear to your right forehead. And it enhances your concentration and your ability to learn. I actually had one of the engineers associated with my laboratory build me one. But they use them today to improve the training for snipers. It enhances their focus. It enhances their motor learning. So you can do that today non-invasively. So can it happen better in the future? Absolutely.
Amazing technology. Nelson is truck driving near Houston. Hey, Nelson, go ahead.
Hey, buddy. How's it going, man? Long-time listener. Been listening to you all night. My question is, y'all are talking about the whole, well, your mind's in it because you can download your brain into a computer and be in this alternate, reality. Well, there was a movie a while back with Tom Cruise where he was in this, alternate reality. He ended up killing himself so he could be in this alternate reality. And then he doesn't know he's in it. And when he finds out, his brain just can't handle it. My question is, when you're in this, alternate reality, do you think you'll know you're in it? And if you figure out you are in it, do you think your brain can process that kind of information?
I think I remember that movie. Was it called Vanilla Sky?
Yeah, that's what it is. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah,
it's a great movie. I don't think your brain could handle that, knowing that a dream's completely different from, living in a computer.
Now, I guess here's the question is it going to be your brain or is it going to be a computer rendering of your brain that is trying to handle that information? If it's a computer rendering, it'll probably handle it. If it's your brain, hard to know. I guess the real question will be, I think when we see all this technology, I think in addition, we're going to see tons of new laws and new obligations. And for instance, because there's going to be a duty to disclose, meaning you've got to know if something's real or not real, at least by physical standards. And so I think we're going to see a whole raft of new laws of privacy, for instance, meaning that when does somebody have access to somebody's thoughts and memories and what happens to them. Even, for instance, what if I could download your thoughts after you've died? And who gets the rights to that? And who has permissions to get access to that? So yeah, I think we're going to see a whole interesting collection and new thought on what do we do with all this, after you're dead?
All right, that's a good point. Good point. Thanks.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was thinking about it, talking about that, and I was like, man, I just don't know if I woke up and I was controlling everything. I just don't know if I could process that kind of information.
Again, it depends on whether it's your brain or whether it's a computer-generated brain.
What would you prefer, Michael and Eric? What would you prefer for him? A computer-generated brain?
Well, I get it depends on the fidelity of the computer-generated brain. If it's an exact match, I don't think you'll tell a difference.
No, that's probably true. Let's go to Chris in Elbridge, New York. Chris, you're on Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good
gentlemen, first time caller on Wild Card. The 666 mark is the mark of the beast, but the scientific number of mankind is 666. And you're not going to get a person, like Bill Gates made Microsoft, you're not going to get a person to make the mark of the beast because it takes an entire corporation of people to be able to control buying and selling. That you can do that with a credit card or your license. You can get a job and your card is registered. You're in, you're out. And when some government can control that card, they can control everything you do, basically, for a living. That's the basic analyst of the 666. Your present time that we're living in is the end times of Scripture. And that 666 is just the mark of mankind, which is the most cruel thing to the earth that has been on the earth. You know, mankind is World War One, World War Two, and they're trying to get World War Three. We're the most cruel things on the earth, as far as we can tell. The game plan for the end of the earth is basically we have a brain. We don't have a mind. God is at war against the devil. The devil has a mind. God is a mind. We are survivors in the existence of life. And be ye like-minded in Christ means you serve God and not serve the devil, basically. But we don't have a mind. People don't have minds. We have a brain. And that's complicated enough for us.
Well, that's an interesting take, too, Eric. Let me elaborate a little bit on what he's saying. What's the difference between the brain and the mind?
Well, I'd see it in this way, is that the brain is our physical structure. You can almost think of it as the hardware. And our mind, I think of in terms of our software, that it is the dynamic motion of the brain that gives us a level of complexity. And it's so, for instance, if I have a physical brain in front of me that is, detached from a living, human body, that it doesn't contain a mind in it because it's no longer processing the electrical signals. It's no longer active and moving. Whereas the mind, I think, is really that motion of the neurons, the electrical activity of the neurons, which has a property that's higher, that basically is more than the sum of its parts, which creates this sense of awareness, sense of self, and capability of manipulating information. So the brain is the physical stuff. The mind is the unbelievably complex electrical activity that is an emergent property beyond the sum of its parts.
Sean is in Sanford, Maine, east of the Rockies. Sean, good morning to you.
Hi, guys.
Howdy.
Good morning.
Yes, I am simultaneously interested, excited, and disturbed by the subject tonight. I'm very intelligent. I've absorbed a lot of information on the internet over the course of the last 15 years or so. And basically, I can, the space of 30 to 45 seconds, present the doctor with a few questions and a comment, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yes, the first one, I don't know whether he has a notepad or not to keep track of these things, but one of them might have been touched on already. But first of all, how do you foresee the progression of brain augmentation on a relatively low-cost, widespread use basis? For example, do you have any predictions when we will interface with the internet directly from the brain? Employ memory enhancement interfaces and virtual total immersion. So I don't know whether you want to take one at a time.
Sure.
Or...
So, I mean, when do we see the early stuff, the early cognitive enhancements? I can say the early stuff is happening right now, as I was mentioning, with transcranial direct stimulation. That stuff's easy. I actually have one at home. As we start to think about implants and true kind of, you know, memory manipulation, cognitive enhancements, I made a bet with a fellow scientist to say that the first what I call the cosmetic neurosurgical procedure,
yeah,
I think will happen within 20 years.
Okay. And as far as this is more interesting to me, mind uploading and as it's also known as whole brain emulation,
mm-hmm.
Do you think the mind is reducible to the brain's processes? In other words, in a materialistic perspective, or do you think dualistically, is the mind an emergent property of the brain and other unknown processes? And how tall of a task do you think it will be to upload the brain? And what type of test do you think would be employed to determine whether it's the actual sentience of the original person?
Yeah, those are very good questions. Those are very, very good questions. Meaning, first off, how hard is this to do? And the answer is it's very hard, but our ability to do it is getting exponentially better every year. So while, yes, this is an unbelievably hard problem, our massive improvement in computer processing, neural engineering is also going at such a pace that it will match that, I think, in 20 to 40 years. And that's why I set my book at 2053, really 40 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you also asked a really very insightful question is, how do we know if we try to upload a brain, if we basically are trying to download our intelligence, how do we know that something truly is self-aware? And that is incredibly hard because there's this, and I'm sure, and maybe for the audience, that there's this idea of called the Turing test, which that is the test to see if somebody if what you're interacting with is aware, self-aware. And basically the whole crux of this test is that a human is talking to somebody on the other side of a curtain. And if that human can't tell that if that human thinks that individual that it's talking to on the other side of the curtain is human because it just can't tell because they have a natural interaction, then most likely that entity on the other side is aware, that it is self-aware, that it passes the Turing test for consciousness and true intelligence. But even today, you can get computer programs that can pass the Turing test, that can fool people into thinking that it's aware. And so it'll become that'll be a very hard test to do. And I don't know if I have a full answer for you.
Eric, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to our final segment with Dr. Eric Luthart. Eric, late night for you tonight. I hope you're not operating on somebody in the morning, huh?
No, not tomorrow. Not tomorrow.
Good. Took the day. Given choices, how many people would really want to have their brains altered with chips? What do you think?
You know, I actually ask that question a lot when I'm giving lectures. And, you know, usually a few people raise their hands. And so I think that the percentage today is probably on the smaller side. I think what's interesting is that as we see kind of these generational advances where people have new ideas about privacy versus access versus capability. I think, for instance, if we would have told somebody 20 years ago, okay, who wants to put all their personal information up on this freely available internet service? We're going to call it Facebook. Maybe one or two people would raise their hand. And so I think that, you know, as we see a progression of time, I think that the notion of, you know, changing yourself and making your mind accessible is going to change over the next couple decades.
I think you're right. And people, I think, will be won over, I think, when they start seeing some of these applications and stuff. I'm not sure I would do it today, but who knows what would happen down the line.
Well, I think especially when you start to think about, for instance, let's just imagine two lawyers, you know, 20 years down the road. One can use their brain to have access to all the legal documents and information at a moment's thought, whereas the other one doesn't have it. Suddenly, you're going to see kind of an emerging competition, whereas that you just got to have it, right? Because, you know, how do you interact with the world? The same with smartphones. You know, the moment those started to come online, and we saw that, you know, gosh, my life is so much better with this. The question is, should I do it or is it ethical? It's more like, why not?
Exactly. It's interesting with smartphones. I think primarily they were fueled by younger people, weren't they?
That's right. And in some senses, the young generation leads us.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Let's take some final calls here for you, Eric. Let's go to Tracy in Denver, Colorado. Hi, Trace. Go ahead.
Hello, gentlemen. I just like to make a few comments. It occurred to me that, you could download the mind, memories, and thoughts, but how can you really download the inclination or the essence of a human heart into a personality? And when someone's born, the energies of the astrological bodies in the heavens affect that personality. So you're never really going to completely capture the original person. The other thing I was thinking, too, the people who have a lot of money and power who can afford these technologies to perpetuate themselves are frequently the psychopaths that are running our banks. Okay? And it makes more sense to me to just focus on our environment, to keep our bodies healthy, and use technologies for therapy purposes, not competition. And that's what I think when you start, I see that it opens up a whole area for a lot of abuse. I don't know how you can capture, you know, Mother Teresa or Gandhi's heart and spirit into a downloaded chip.
I think they have the ability. They're going to be able to do stuff like that. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, you know, and I think that to your point, I think there's going to be different settings for different people of what they think is appropriate. I think people who really take a more naturalist perspective, which I think is completely fine, are going to say, you know what, that's not for me. And are willing to, for instance, maybe make some sacrifices for that naturalist perspective. Just as today, some people say, you know what, smartphones aren't for me. I don't like being connected. It may limit them in certain ways. And as we were talking about with, you know, playing in the garage earlier, that, you know, maybe you benefit in other ways by really forcing your brain to be more creative. And so it's a give and take. And I think that as these technologies emerge, I think we'll have more and more options to choose what's right for us.
These inventions that you've come up with and these patents, what kinds of products have you created here?
Well, a lot of it is medical technology. So one of my earliest ones, as an example, is a brain-computer interface that restores function to stroke patients. So, for instance, a patient with a paralyzed hand, as an example, who's had a paralyzed hand for years, they can put on a head cap, and 30 minutes later, they can put on an exoskeleton and start controlling that hand. I've done a lot of brain-computer interface technologies, a lot of imaging technologies, a lot of brain mapping technologies. A lot of actually computer software user interface interactions so that computers can understand your emotions. So really across the board.
Are you seeing any patterns right now with people who are coming in with, neuro issues?
Well, I think some of the main groups of patients that I treat are patients with brain tumors and with epilepsy. And I think one of the things that I see with epilepsy especially is that in some senses, this disease, whereas you have these random moments where you lose consciousness, which prevents you from driving, it really highlights the dependence that we have on technology today. The inability to drive a car is so disabling because people, you know, we live in a distributed society where it's hard for people to get to work if they can't drive. They really become very dependent, and it's interesting, not because of the disease, but the inability to use technology.
Let's go to our truck driver in Florida. Mark is with us east of the Rockies. Mark, thanks for hanging with us. Go ahead.
Yes, very thought-provoking show,
sure
pun intended. It's my understanding that the cell reproduction process of the brain is based on no memory, so to speak. A cell is reproduced, exactly the same as the one that has aged before it. Is it possible to stimulate the brain to, say, skip back a few years to reproduce a cell, say, before an injury or before an illness, therefore getting the brain to send the electrons through the neurons and whatnot to reproduce a younger cell when it reproduces the cell?
That is a very good question, and that is something that is actively being worked on. And people refer to these as neurostem cells, that can you return a neuron to its earlier, more primordial state as if it was an embryonic cell, basically a cell when it was basically, you know, a fetus. And there is evidence that you can do it, but it's really in its early stages of actually implementing that clinically, so that we are replacing brain cells today with earlier versions of those cells.
Next up, we go to Kevin in Kentucky. Welcome to the program. Kevin, go ahead.
Yes, I am a schizophrenic myself, and I've had visions, and I've seen things like I've seen fairies. I've seen double moons while Moonbow was happening at the falls here in Kentucky, and I didn't know one was happening at the same time as the other. And I've seen portals through trees. Everything has been natural. And it wasn't while I was doing drugs or nothing like that. It was, I guess, because of the schizophrenia, but everything seemed natural. Now, what if I could go back to that, have the chip, and re-enhance in that element and find out information and see if those things are real in a different reality, in our reality?
Well, they are real. And, if you visualize it, it becomes real. There's no doubt about
okay.
it.
Okay. Now, if I have a chip that enhances that moment, what would happen?
Because of schizophrenia, obviously that's a very serious diagnosis. And you run into the trouble of, like you say, knowing what is real and what is not real. And maybe these type of devices are, as we understand both how the brain works and how it doesn't work and how it may be misinterpreting information, that it can give you a better sense of what is the product of normal stuff coming into your senses versus what your brain is creating and in some senses fooling you.
Huh. Let's go to West, Gary in San Diego. Hey, Gary, go ahead.
Yeah, George, thanks for taking my call. Great show, as usual. I wanted to ask the doctor a question and make a comment about something you said. Doctor, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's about 5 years ago, and my voluntary muscles are, I'm kind of slow. My involuntary muscles are good. What do I have to look forward to as far as breakthroughs for my situation? And George, we used to play pinball machines. I don't know where you grew up, but we were playing nickel pinball machines back in the day.
Anyhow,
I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you very much again.
Sure thing. Detroit for me. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah. So I think that Parkinson's disease is an area of extremely rapid growth, and as I mentioned, the medications are improving that they're using. The use of deep brain stimulators is a really tried and true technology now that I think has really helped hundreds of thousands of people. And I think that that type of technology, making it more advanced, making it more sensitive to brain activity, making it more able to treat the disease for longer, is getting nothing but better. So I think that is a disease that I think there's a lot of solutions now and a lot more solutions coming down the pike.
Who's fueling the technology, corporations or individuals like yourself who come up with these great ideas and inventions?
You know, it really is a combination. So, in some senses, to think about the pipeline is that the science happens by the government funding science so that we receive grants from the government to do this work at academic institutions, and that as we come up with discoveries, come up with ideas, that then the goal becomes to translate them so that companies will then make the technology that they can then sell to hospitals and patients as for new therapies. So it's a really long process that transitions from government support to industry support to the patient. So it really requires, in some senses, all segments of society.
All right, Victor, she's truck driving in California now. Go ahead, Victor.
Hi. Just a question about maybe having a chip where you could hijack somebody's brain. In lieu of waterboarding, maybe a chip that would force them to speak the truth only, or in a criminal case to where you could ask questions and know that you're getting the truth.
Right. That's a great question. And actually, those are elements that I talk a lot about in my book, actually. If you're suspected of doing a crime, what are the legal ramifications if I can actually know what you did, not just what you're telling me that you did, what people saw or say that you did, but I can, look into your prosthetic and I can draw, upon your memories to get the truth. And I think that chances are that, and I would actually hope that a certain degree of privacy is maintained, that your mind, even if you can access it, that it is still sacrosanct. It is still kind of your property wholly. And if you want to tell people what your thoughts and memories are, that's fine. But nobody should have the right to actually take it without your permission.
Great. Thank you for that, Eric. Let's take a couple more calls, and we are out of time. Dan is in Las Vegas. Go ahead, Dan.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the call. I wanted to, I've been listening to a very interesting show you got there. And I've studied the mind for 30 years. I finally gave it up because I got a little tongue got beat up after a while. But I wanted to let you know the difference between the mind and the soul. First of all, the brain is not the mind. The mind is completely separate. There is the mind, there is the soul, there is the heart, and there is, oh my goodness, there's something else. But let me explain this real quick about there's two. When they say feelings, as when you say feelings, there are two kinds of feelings. One is emotion that you feel with your heart. That's the other one that I wanted to, that I couldn't remember, the heart. The other feeling is the soul. The soul has the sensation, whether, and the mind, and the heart has the emotion. When you cry, when you feel sad, when you feel happy, those are your emotions. That's one
now,
feeling.
And your emotions are coming from very specific places in your brain. The names of those locations are called the amygdala or the insula of the brain. And actually, interestingly, if you injure those areas, you lose your capacity for emotion. So it really is in your emotions are in your brain.
When the brain is damaged, okay, when it hits a certain part of the brain, it affects you, of course, emotionally. Does it not, Eric?
Absolutely, it does. And depending on which area is affected, it can affect your what I call emotional regulation. So sometimes people with severe head injuries really have a tough time afterwards, not because they have lost intelligence, but they've lost their ability to control themselves emotionally. So sometimes they have the reputation of having a bad temper afterwards, or that inappropriately cry.
Or they're more spiritual. Something like that happens too, doesn't it?
That sometimes can happen.
Let's go next to Adam in Pittsburgh. Hey, Adam, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling. Good morning.
Morning, guys. Digressing real quick, NSA is going to need a bigger building, obviously, if we go this route.
But, sure, huge server.
But real quick, I want to, I think in previous guest a couple weeks ago, I was talking about the frequencies of different body parts and of the body.
Yeah.
Is there a measured frequency in the brain, and could a scan be developed hey, if you patent this, just send me a T-shirt or something. Could you scan it ahead of an event rather quickly? And if there was a traumatic event, be able to rescan rather quickly to determine if more investigation was needed?
Let me make sure I understand the question. So could you basically scan the brain to know kind of what events are going to happen? Did I get that correctly?
I'm sorry. Say before a football game, you had your players scan the frequency of the brain, and I didn't really understand 100% what the previous guest was talking about, but you scan the frequency of the brain, and you got a certain baseline frequency, and then during the game, there was a pretty significant hit on the player. And
off the field. That notion is very interesting. And actually, they're looking at it in the military as well, is that knowing kind of where you're set right now, and then monitoring in a real-time fashion to see, shoot, did we get a bad hit, perturbation, whatever, so that we know when basically things aren't working right, and so that we take you either out of the battle scenario or out of the play scenario to prevent things from getting worse by another hit. Now, that is something that's being worked on right now by a lot of different groups, because I think that's a really interesting approach.
We are out of time, Eric. Go get some sleep. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Eric Luthard, and Red Devil 4 is his book. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.